Welcome to Measured Impact, where we share behind-the-scenes stories of the world's leading mission-driven companies. Because when it comes to activism, brand building, and revenue growth, we believe profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. Let's dive in. Today on Measured Impact, we are joined by Belinda Bork, External Affairs and Reporting Lead at Tony's Chocolony and OpenChain, the collaborative initiative launched by Tony's to eradicate exploitation in the cocoa sector. Instead of guarding their supply chain as a corporate secret, Tony's OpenChain has open sourced it, inviting direct competitors and retail giants to buy cocoa through their ethical framework. Today, they serve as the impact engine for over 22 global corporate mission allies, and Belinda's work sits directly at the intersection of rigorous supply chain management and human storytelling, asking how business can scale industry-wide change without losing operational efficiency and accountability. Belinda, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I'll start with an easy one. Who are you? Where do you live? And what does Tony's do?
Those are easy one. Which one of those was easy? well, basically, my name, as you already mentioned, is Belinda, and I've worked for Tony's now for a little over 6.5 years. I am usually based in Amsterdam, where also Tony's Chocolony was originally started. So we started as a Dutch initiative of a bunch of journalists who were investigating the cocoa supply chain or the chocolate industry, more generally speaking, and they realized things are not going well. And they started with a media stunt. So one of the journalists actually sued himself. He was the one without kids. So they decided if the lawsuit was going to go through, he could go to prison. It was fine. And then they had a proper trial. So the journalists really did what journalists do best. They did amazing PR around all of this in the Netherlands back in 2005. However, the lawsuit could not go ahead because ultimately there was no way to connect the chocolate bar that's Jane van der Koken, you already get a hint at the name of Tony's there, was eating on camera and had basically said, I have knowingly consumed a product made from child and forced labor. Sue me, take me to prison. But there was no way to connect the cocoa and where the cocoa is grown to this chocolate bar because there simply wasn't any supply chain traceability. So the lawsuit itself was dropped. The charges were dropped. Jane never had to go to prison. However, the idea was born and Tony's lonely fight in the chocolate industry, so Tony's Chocolonely, was started in the Netherlands in 2005. That's also still where our headquarters are. And from there on, we expanded quite significantly. And so for the past 20 plus years now, we've expanded into an office in London as well. We have an office in New York as well, one in Hamburg. And of course, we also have one in Abidjan and also one in Accra. So Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, the two countries where we source the cocoa from.
Wow. Talk a little bit about you. Your background seems to have crossed into politics and journalism and social reporting. What drew you to the mission at Tony's?
I think ultimately, so I did my master's in the Netherlands already. So in the Netherlands, nearly now 10 years ago, it was next to impossible to escape Tony's Chocolonely. And I think what I was drawn to at the time was this idea that we can use business as a force for good. So the idea that also, for example, stands behind B Corp, that we can really work with the mechanisms that we already have in place to do something better, to make the world a better place. Because ultimately, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We have the frameworks available, and we do have the kind of capitalist motivators all around it, right? So there are these money-making machines, these companies that do exist, and if they existed with a core of good, we could make the world a better place with the structures that we currently have. I think that was one of the main factors that drew me to Tony's, because actually beforehand, I had completed an internship in Parliament in the UK. So I'd seen the politics and that side of things. And while that's absolutely wonderful as well, it's a different game, right? So for me, there was a bit of that call towards a company that is inherently trying to do things differently while also still very much being a profit-driven organization as well.
Yeah, it's a really cool model, and you can sort of see you've had a chance to dabble both from the political side and then almost the, you know, nonprofit journalism side where the motivations are different and things move at a different pace and there's a different kind of culture to it also. I very much get the the desire. You mentioned Tony's is a lonely fight against inequality. How has that changed and evolved over time, right? So it seems like from the beginning, there was clearly a values, mission-driven, this had purpose from before products were even generated. But what's changed over the last 20 years, or even maybe just the last six for you guys, about how you think about the model for having an impact?
I think on the one hand, everything has changed. And on the other hand, the core has always stayed the same. So I think those are ultimately the two sides to that answer. So what we've always done, as you were saying, even before the company was started, was raising awareness around the issues, right? So we see that as our first pillar and really the starting point of what we also still very much do, right? So we talk about child labor, forced labor, deforestation, lack of a living income, all of the issues that do exist in Cocoa are for us something that we don't shy away from. What has evolved over time is this quite quirky, funky brand and the beautiful colors that it comes in. And that developed from 2005 onwards for, I would say the following decade, a lot was done not only on the marketing side, so on the looks of it and kind of the way that the Tony story is also being told and the way that the graphics work, but definitely also on the sustainability side. So over the years, what we have developed is an impact model, because we see ourselves as an impact company that makes chocolate, not the other way around, which definitely means that the chocolate sales are central to what we're trying to achieve, but they're a means to an end. So they're always towards the goal to make impact. And the impact model that stands behind the chocolate bar itself has evolved by, for example, back in 2012, we started having supply chain traceability, something that was very vital because that was the major point in the lawsuit as to why that couldn't go ahead, right? So to actually be able to trace back the cocoa to cooperatives, to farms, and be able to have a segregated supply chain flow. Back in 2012, we were told this is absolutely insane and something that cannot be done for the industry. Nowadays, we're looking at deforestation regulation that is requiring exactly that, plot tracking for every type of cocoa that comes into the EU. So we've seen a development over time. Moving on from 2012, we've developed our five sourcing principles that ultimately are a comprehensive and kind of systemic approach to the issues that exist in cocoa, but that are also trying to look at different angles, because it might happen that the moment that you know where your cocoa comes from, who it is produced by, but also where it is produced, you've actually not yet done anything, right? So far, you've only found out whether or not there are issues. But now the next step is to actually do something about this issue. So one of those steps is then to say, well, the cocoa price itself is clearly not high enough. So we need to pay a higher price for cocoa that enables a living income. In addition to that, we also realize at this point, we work with over 40,000 farmers. That cannot be a one-on-one relationship. So we work via strong cooperatives as well. So we work via a co-op model where we implement via these cooperatives who are ultimately the ones with the boots also on the ground. On top of that, quality and productivity, out of question that is needed, and that we need to make sure that the cocoa comes from the existing plots and that cocoa farms do not encroach into protected areas, as well as improving things like biodiversity and working on agroforestry measure. But all of these measures can be implemented and might also have already come on different kinds of sustainability programs already. The really crucial factor is none of this will happen overnight. So the long-term commitment, so the fact that we work for a minimum of 5 years with cooperatives and implement everything with this view of we don't expect radical changes and everything to have improved by the next season, is one of the crooks that we've developed and where we've realized that really does make a difference, because you give a chance for positive development. And that has happened over time. And I would say over 2015 to 2018, we then had really our approach also settled with small tweaks along the way, right? So we are still far from perfect and we're finding out loads of things along the way. But as we are learning, we're adapting this now fundamental approach of these five sourcing principles, which is why we've then felt confident to say, look, we know it's working for us. We know it's working for Tony's Chocolate Only. And I would say that the next big turning point then was in 2018-19. So that season when we had our first mission ally join, where we've taken the steps. So if our first pillar is we lead, the first pillar is we raise awareness. Our second pillar is we lead by example. So we show the five sourcing principles. We then said, well, we need a certain type of hydraulic effect to actually make this happen in the industry. So that is where we inspire others to act, and where we've then said, this is actually not something that we want to be precious about. This is something that we want to share with everyone, and this is how we believe we can change the industry. So we've just invited everyone to join us.
It's great. I selfishly am very interested in how you guys think about that first step, which was raising awareness. So for you guys as a team, how do you measure awareness? How do you think about knowing the quality or the quantity of that awareness?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to different things. So on the one hand, of course, there are things like, for example, in our reporting, we do have brand and issue awareness KPIs, right? So we could go down the boring route right now and we could talk about focus group and stakeholder engagement, but I'm not going to do that. But I feel like I need to mention it. So we definitely also do that. But I think the more interesting part is there is a bit of a change in discourse. And I will, again, use that link to in 2012, we were told that traceability wasn't possible, but that has happened over time. And I think what we've seen for loads of other topics, like, for example, the topic of a living income for cocoa farmers, that ultimately is now very much something that is being discussed, right? So basically the public discourse is changing over time, and that's what we want to contribute to, and that's what we also want to shape, ultimately speaking. So the issue awareness, on the one hand, of course, with the industry itself, but also the awareness of how cocoa, for example, is grown with a general consumer, because whom are we kidding? Most, maybe nearly all of us are eating chocolate. So we should know a lot more about the ingredient that basically guides this product. And to just raise awareness around the issues in it and to see how people respond to it and ultimately what kind of questions you also start getting and how you're being challenged on certain things. I feel like that's also something where you can really see a step up in awareness, and where also sometimes we realize that we've talked about maybe the human rights side of things more than we've talked about the environmental side, right? So that's also a step change that we've seen over time, where we've actually realized, oh, we can also talk about that broad range of topics that we do have in scope and make sure that all of this lands with the wider public.
We talk to a lot of brands like yours where, you know, we hear that the consumers often want to make ethical purchases and they want to speak with their wallets, but then there's still a large tendency to buy based on price. It's like you said, you know, you guys are a profit-driven business who happens to lead with impact. How do you think about turning that awareness into willingness to change the purchase behavior?
Yeah, I think definitely a fundamental and really good question. I think I would nearly want to take a step back and first challenge the question as to whether or not it always needs to lie with the consumer. So we are definitely a profit-driven business, but as we are also leading with impact, we are also majorly investing in our impact model. I would say that it is a fundamental part of who we are, right? So Tony's Chocolonely in itself is, as I was saying, an impact company. So by purchasing a chocolate bar, you are purchasing a chocolate bar not from a chocolate company, but from an impact company. So that makes it inherently important. So I would say, yes, there's that element to it. Is it okay if there's also consumers that kind of start by getting excited because the wrapper looks good on shelf? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you guys have a very bubbly, ephemeral brand that sort of has a natural playfulness and fun to it. I'm curious how you think about natural sort of balance with the more serious side that you're also talking about. It's contrasting, right? The seriousness of the issues and the impact that you're trying to have versus the kind of fun of both the product, but also just the branding and the colors and the fonts. And it's very playful. Is that intentional?
Again, really good question. And I must say, I'm already smiling because I'm imagining anyone from our impact marketing side listening to that, because they know what kind of a pain in the ass I can be when it comes to fact checking something or slightly wanting to reframe something, because they have used what we call
Tony. And now somebody's asking you what you think about the fonts and how playful it is. So welcome, impact marketing folks. We're happy to be on your side.
Exactly. I was going to say this one goes out to Diana. No, but ultimately, I do believe that while it is a difficult balance to strike, and it's not always straightforward, and it's not always the most easy thing to do, it's 100% necessary. Because ultimately, if we were to get lost in difficult lingo, and if we basically create this nearly like academic layer, because that actually then fundamentally describes in specific detail exactly what we are doing from a sustainability point of view, we lose the majority of people. So it is 100% intentional to simplify and make Tony's story more accessible, because that's ultimately what we want to achieve, right? So we don't want to raise awareness with the chosen few that actually understand certain really difficult terms, or in my case, I use way too many abbreviations, one of their main pain points, but rather to find a way to create an approachable narrative that then can be heard by the masses and therefore also consumed and understood by the masses is 100% what we're aiming for.
Okay, so let me double click on the storytelling a little bit. Clearly, part of your ability to impact is to connect with an audience about the impact that you're having or seeking to have or changes in the industry. So talk about what works well for you guys when it comes to telling that story and when that's done most effectively. And that could be wherever you want to take it.
I think a lot of the relatable storytelling and creating a narrative that does make sense also needs to come from a place where people understand based on a real life example for themselves. So, for example, there's no questions that parents, wherever they are in the world, want the best for their children. So instead of talking about a child labor narrative, we talk about children's rights. The moment that we talk about going to school, that's something that all parents can relate to that have children that already go to school. So there's kind of the connection to something that can hook into your own daily life and that you can relate to, I think is an absolute fundamental that we're trying to create. One thing that I like to use quite a lot is when we talk about children that also, when they're a bit older, so 14, 15, 16, if they go to the farm and they help their parents after school with light work, because they learn their parents' trade and they start understanding how their parents make money. I tend to, on the one hand, it's good for everyone to understand what the parents are doing. On the other hand, I was also told as a kid to empty the dishwasher and to not end up being a spoiled little brat. So I think there is some similarities there that we can tease out where we're ultimately all the same, right? So, and I think if we get that narrative right and if we get that connection there, we start communicating not only about facts and we start talking about a deeper kind of emotional level where we start to understand issues instead of just using labels that mean nothing to anyone, like human rights due diligence. That's not something that will ever trigger any emotions deep down in your heart. But the moment that we talk about a child's right to play, that's already a bit of a different tweak to it.
I love that answer. It's a really cool approach. I'm curious, can you kind of pull the curtain back a little bit? What are the mechanics of that for you guys? How does that actually look, like impact team versus marketing team? How do you guys actually collaborate to make that happen?
So in the team that I lead for Tony's Open Chain, we are responsible for the Tony's Open Chain impact report. And one side of that is definitely the dry KPIs of tracking what is happening and which type of progress
did
we
you
are
just
making.
Label it the dry KPIs? That's a burn to marketers. Wow, it's good. I like it.
I mean, it is true, right? So it does come down to exactly that. But what that also means is that instead of only looking at numbers, and again, I'll keep up the human rights due diligence and children's right to play example here, because what we could also be looking at is how many child labor cases were remediated last year. That number in itself, again, of course, we will report on it because we will also report on the child labor cases that we have found. And we want to report on the progress that we are making on this matter. But on the other hand, we are also reporting on how did remediation actually work? What is it about a case that means that a child labor case is solved? And then it becomes already a lot more individual, a lot more personal, and also a lot more tangible. So if I were now to tell you that remediation of cases actually doesn't always look the same. So there's different levels of it. So on the one hand, there might be an individual solution. So it might be related to one child in a very particular case needing a birth certificate and therefore they're not going to school because they've never been registered. They're not caught in the system currently. But on the other hand, we might find in a village that 15 children are not going to school. And that might be because the school's too far away. So at some point, you also start asking yourself, does it make sense to have a maybe little community school in that place? For other cases, or a huge factor for us has been if children don't stay at school through lunch break because there isn't a school canteen. So school canteens might be a community solution as well. But all of this already colors in that number of remediated cases that we do report on. So that's definitely one part of it, to create a narrative around the KPI report that we do have in place. in addition to that, and kind of taking this a step further, what we've done in the last report as well is we've created a couple of a day in the life of stories. So on the one hand, we have a cooperative president and kind of basically what does his daily life look like? But again, to stay with the same example of the remediators cases from before, we also put in a lot of pictures and the storytelling of one of the community facilitators. Those are the people that are employed by the cooperative that visit each and every single household to have conversations about child labor and to see whether child labor exists there. And ultimately, if a case of child labor is found, to also have a conversation with the household members about what the best remediation activity would be. So again, it's about the next level of emotional storytelling, where we really use an example of someone who does the work day in, day out, and doesn't only talk about the work they do, but also what kind of person they are and how they stand behind it.
Yeah, you're sort of bringing a tangible humanness to the issue, so that's not a number. I'm curious, what are the mechanisms to find those stories? How do the boots on the ground folks who are having these interactions, how do they identify like, oh man, this is a story that will really articulate the impact we're trying to have? How does that get flagged? How do you guys think about identifying where those narratives are most powerful when you find them?
I think, so first of all, because we have a Tony's Open Chain team in Ghana and we have a Tony's Open Chain team also in Cote d'Ivoire. So sitting in Amsterdam, we have a direct connection and, loads of also online meetings. So we already have the direct connection in country. But then on top of that, the direct connection, again, fostered by those teams in country to the cooperatives, means that we have a very direct personal link that is also created over the long term, which gives the chance to also see who, for example, would want to tell their story. So we have a couple of cooperative managers and presidents that are either, for example, there's one who's very poetic. So he tends to make these wonderful big statements that you can always use as quotes. But that's just also his style. So that's also not something that we've ever looked for. But the moment that you sit in a meeting with him, you will definitely realize that he has a very poetic way about him. So then we obviously seek him out for something like that. While there's others who are also quite keen to be platformed and do not shy away from an audience. So they might then also be actually pulled into whether that is panel discussions or other types of interviews. So it's not necessarily seeking out the stories, but kind of seeing opportunities based on also what people want, because it would never be something where we go out hunting for something that we then force upon someone. So it's more what naturally happens in an ecosystem that we do have in place via the 22 cooperatives that we currently work with.
It seems like you guys are tracking a lot, both quantitatively and on the sort of qualitative side of just keeping your pulse on how these cooperatives are operating and what the impact is that you're having. With all that numerical data, whether that's the stuff you guys use in your impact report or behind the scenes things that the public maybe might not see, can you give me an example of a time where a piece of data or a finding that was metric driven changed how you guys approached something, where you learned something from a piece of data that said, oh, that was a different output than we expected or a different outcome than we expected?
I would say we have at least one of those learnings every single year. There's always something where we realize along the way, but I'll give you two examples. So on the one hand, as I was mentioning, we have a sourcing principle that looks at paying more for cocoa. And if we talk about a living income is a quite complex concept in itself, right? So it's related to prosperity, to resilience, and how a household can maybe also handle financial shocks. So there's loads of elements that come into that that go just beyond the price of cocoa. But what we've also realized is based on the pricing that we do have in place, which is the normal farm gate price that everyone kind of has to pay, and additional premiums that then add up to what is called the living income reference price, is that cooperatives were saying that they would love to pay out even more to also the farmers, but they also need to run their systems. So what we saw over time is that there's an additional need for financing for the cooperatives to actually run the systems and run the sourcing principles for them as a business. So we started paying a cooperative management fee in addition to the living income reference price that ends up with a cocoa and per metric ton for the farmers. So these kind of tweaks along the way are a very straightforward example of how we constantly evolve our model, how we're constantly learning, and how we always see change is necessary, right? So no one knows everything. The conditions are constantly changing. Let's not get started on climate change right now. But those are definitely learnings that we can take in, and where we also have a flexibility to kind of add things to the approach and kind of reflect on how certain things should be working. Another example, again, also linked to the cases of child labor that we had reported on. In that year, we had reported on 1,702 cases of child labor that we had found in our supply chain. And that in itself is a good sign, because that means our systems are working and child labor is very present. However, we then made it onto the cover of a big UK newspaper for Easter, and the clickbaity headline was ethical chocolate brand finds 1,700 cases or has child labor in their supply chain, and then the text mentioned 1,700 cases, which was the part that upset me the most, because at least like use our actual numbers. So what happened to the two cases that they suddenly cut out? But ultimately, what this came down to was the sustainability reporting team and the marketing team sat together, and we could not have been more prepared for the answer to this, because yes, we're finding child labor, and this is what we're doing about it. So this realization that our radical transparency actually is such a good engine for us to position our story and to position our impact model, it was a huge learning. So that was great.
You guys clearly aren't scared to go out and talk about the impact, positive or negative, but it's hard, right? Like show up on a UK paper with a bad headline, and there's a tendency, especially in business, to sort of shy away from that. So how do you guys think about preparing for the case? What conversations do you have internally ahead of time? Or how do you think about knowing that sometimes awareness of an issue is going to come with a potential lens that is not always the most positive for you guys?
There's definitely always a preparation of FAQ prior to going public with anything, where we do already address complexities and risks that come with any story that we do tell. So there will be preset also bullet point answers that then can be formulated into proper text and copy, simply because we need to outline these parts as well. So there is a lot of preparation that is also happening on the marketing side, and that also happens with the input from the sustainability team. And I would say, aside from kind of having done this type of pre-work, I think it's also about looking at it from the direction of, we want to tell the story because ultimately that completes our cycle. So the cycle is, as I was saying, so if we look at the three pillars, so it is about knowing about an issue, then in our case, then doing something about the issue, and then making sure that that kind of spreads further. And again, that's also something, right? So if this spreads into other industries, great, right? So whether that's applied to coffee or tomatoes, whatever it can be, so that kind of hydraulic effect ultimately then leads to actual change. So not shying away from talking about something is how we can ultimately do good. Because the moment we don't talk about it, we don't have the awareness, and then there's no questions being asked, and so no one feels obligated to do anything.
Yeah, well, and I think what it sounds like for you guys is that the sort of ethos of how the company was started impacts that still today, right? Like if you're starting with, you know, arrest me, then, you know, you can kind of keep some of that attitude towards, no, we're going to talk about what's real. And sometimes that's great. Sometimes maybe that has potential to make us look not as spotless as others might want to be. I'm curious how you guys think about your impact reports specifically for the chain. So tell us what that looks like. What does it consist of, and kind of how often do you do it?
We do it annually. So it's a wonderful exercise that, quite comprehensively for my team looks at our cocoa supply chain. And we have a wide range of KPIs that track different aspects of
KPIs. That's what someone said. Very dry, boring KPIs.
Well, you said boring, I said dry. But it comes down to a bit of both of those. But ultimately, indeed, we have a reporting specialist who looks after the assurance process of that as well, because indeed, it's not just us tracking that, but we have third-party limited assurance on all of the KPIs as well. And in addition to that, we also do get limited text assurance. That means that some claims or some sentences from our report will be pulled out, and we need to prove them separately. Can imagine that a little bit like if you ever wrote any essays at uni and you had to footnote certain things that weren't your own, that's basically limited text assurance in short. So that's part of our impact reporting exercise. And ultimately, the report itself and the way it stands really is a summary of the progress of the last year while contextualizing what type of progress we have made over time as well. So it is trying to look at the issues in cocoa that do exist, how we go about our model at scale, and then tracking on, as I was saying, child labor, the lack of a living income, and deforestation as kind of the main issues that do exist in cocoa.
And just practically, is that launched once a year as a PDF? How does the world engage with the content?
So we are actually about to enter pre-assurance. So it is ultimately about a 6 month exercise, but it's not always equally heavy throughout the year. So the cocoa season starts in October and ends in September, roughly. So that means also our financial year runs this way, and our annual report obviously aligns with our financial year. So we report from 1st of October to 30th of September. And then, yeah, we enter pre-assurance roughly in June now. So that means we have the first kind of walkthroughs of all of the KPIs. There's loads of KPI manuals that stand behind this specific KPI owners. So those will be the specialists that work on specific things. For example, there's a traceability specialist. There is a forest specialist. So they own a set of these KPIs and that now need to be looked after. And we can already establish a couple of trends and look at what the current status is as the year is still running. By September, we then enter into proper assurance. So that is when we actually submit our progress of the year and have our third-party auditor assure it. While they also check the data, we start writing the narrative around these KPIs as well. So that takes roughly from October to December. And then we publish once a year, usually at the end of January or at the beginning of February. And we publish online. So we have a PDF version or a kind of a PDF reader, I should say. And we publish in English and in French, because French is the language spoken in Côte d'Ivoire, and we want to make sure that our cooperatives and also the teams there can fully read and understand everything that we report on as it concerns them directly.
Okay, so put your marketer's hat on for a minute. What is a metric that you use to gauge that the report itself was successful? Does it matter if it's read by a lot of people? Do you care how deep people's understanding is? How do you guys think about the specific metrics and more the consumption side of the report?
I think obviously on the one hand, it is how much it is being read, but I think that also counts over time. So because we will have different pieces in different reports where we will dive into a specific thing, but we won't cover that again the following year because it might be season specific, and whether or not, because you can also link to specific pages that get still referenced in the future, so it's not a 1 year exercise and then that report is entirely retired. So I think that's one part of it. And then on the other hand, there's definitely also an element of who picks it up, who kind of has a look at it. So we do know that loads of NGOs and CSOs, so civil society organizations, also have their eyes on us, and they will certainly read specific chapters that maybe concern them most. And I must say that we also do proactive outreach in that way, that we will also send that through. And on the Tony's Chocolonely side, I believe they also, but I can't speak in too much detail to that, they also send packages out with a lighter printed version of the report, so with just some of the headline stories and a couple of chocolate bars also to specific audiences.
It's a really neat way to approach it, and I imagine you can get people to open something up if it comes with a chocolate bar, so that's pretty neat. Let's jump into a bit of a quick fire where I'll hit on a few questions. And if you just give me a quick fire response, we'll go from there. So today, what brand or organization do you personally look up to?
I would say one of the next steps that I would like to take for us, and where we've done the first little bits of it, is to look into impact valuation and integrated P&Ls. So to really look at the societal value add, and then obviously also break it down in kind of environmental return of investment, social return of investment. So that entire world of actually using the language that is very much spoken in corporates and that is kind of the business driver in itself, but apply that to sustainability and therefore normalize our narratives a lot more. And Natura is leading the way on that. So they have an amazing integrated P&L already. So that is definitely life goals of what they are already achieving there. I think there's other brands, and we sometimes also unofficially, we have a little bit of a group where we get together. Natura is also part of it, but a lot of other names like Patagonia and Oatly, for example, where we come together and we all have a little bit of a different approach of how to go about change in our industry. So there's a lot of cross-learning that can happen. But ultimately, what that definitely comes down to is a lot of companies that are B Corp certified are doing great work. And I think we can all learn a lot from each other, and the way that we might have a slightly tweaked view of our industry and therefore of our approaches and what we can take from each other.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, the ability to kind of hear how others are approaching is still valuable, even in totally different industries. It also sounds like you're really looking to get some more jargon for the marketing team, some more corporate acronyms and things that you can weave into everything. So I'm sure they'll be thrilled about that. What do you wish you could measure?
I think one aspect that we are starting to scratch the surface of is the farmer well-being side of things, because I think there will always be proxies for that, and there will never be a complete picture, and there will always be loads of correlations. So how much of our work is contributing to farmer well-being, I think, is a crux that is great to understand and wonderful to dig in deeper.
What book or podcast do you find yourself recommending most to other folks on your team?
Interesting. So I do recommend a lot of books. I do read quite a lot of novels.
It doesn't have to be a professional, by the way. It can be any angle.
Which one am I going to go for? So one that I've definitely recommended before, because I think she's a very inspiring author overall, and I really loved it, is Poisonwood Bible. It's a beautiful book. So I can highly recommend that one by Barbara Kingsolver. But then another one book that I've just started that I'm very excited about is, and then I need to remember the proper name of it, is it's written by the founder of the Poetry Pharmacy and the CEO of Lush. And so I have a feeling that it'll be really exciting, because they are combining business and poetry, and they're looking at basically what creative mindsets that usually come with being a poet should be integrated into business, and how the business world can learn a lot from the more magical world of poetry. So I'm very excited about that. I'm recommending that without having finished it, but I'm looking forward to finishing it.
All right, now for our last and most important question. If I were coming to Amsterdam, or really anywhere, where would you send me to get the best sandwich?
The best sandwich? Small World, just off Haarlemmerstraat, is by far the best. And then they have a vegetarian option, is a pumpkin one. And then there's one that has a turkey melt. Amazing.
Where can people go to follow more of the work that you guys are doing at Tony's Open Chain and to connect on the issues?
We have a quite active and also informative website. We have lots of our policies up there as well. So in addition to the reports, we actually push out a lot of the work that we do in quite a lot of detail as well. So where we're just trying to, for example, talk about our deforestation risk protocol. So definitely go visit our website. And there's also a way to reach out via the website. And we're always happy to answer any further questions.
Awesome. Belinda Brooke is the Global External Affairs and Reporting Lead for Tony's Charcoal Only and its industry and led initiative, Tony's Open Chain. Belinda joins us from Tuscany, I believe, where she's hanging out with her in-laws. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.